So next week, we will be beginning our deep study, detail study, into the 17 periods. And Sean will be teaching starting next week. And he has the handout for next week already prepared. And so at this time, I'll let him hand those out. So for our visitors, just a little explanation. As I noted, for the last 6 months or so, we have been studying 17 periods of Bible history. The idea is simply to fix in our minds how the Bible is organized and what events go where. And so today, we are going to be reviewing, supposedly reviewing, what we've been doing for the past 6 months. If you're visiting, and maybe even if you're not visiting, I can say that you will never have been through a class like we're going to have today. We're going to try to review the entire Bible in 45 minutes, even less. So we'll see how it goes. To start out and kind of set the table for this, let me just ask you a basic question. How would you describe the Bible? What really is it? What's the main point and what's the main purpose? I think we all probably have a pretty good understanding of that, but how would you describe it? What words? Yeah.
Reading the Bible is teaching us what God wants from us.
I agree with that. I came across a little statement that describes it pretty well, I think. I pulled this out of a book by Farrell Jenkins, who some of us know. And Farrell, in turn, is quoting someone else in this quotation. But here's what it says. The Bible is a unit. Its primary, general, and ultimate object is to develop one great and glorious system of divine wisdom, justice, goodness, mercy, and love through Jesus Christ for the redemption of fallen man. I think that captures it pretty well. And so for these past 6 months, what we've been doing is kind of an overview of the Bible story. The narrative, you might say, has 17 periods. We've gone through each of those. And today is going to be an opportunity, I hope, for us to test our progress a little bit and see what, if any, of this we've retained. Much of what I'm going to mention today is contained in one of the very first handouts you were given almost 6 months ago, a table that purported to summarize the 17 periods, this three cycles approach that Bob Waldron devised. If you have that and you want to look at it today as we go along, okay. I would suggest it might be a better test for you not to look at it and just kind of see how much of this that you've learned. I'm just going to ask a series of questions about some of the things we've covered. And if you want to answer them, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine. I'll provide the answers. And I'm going to mix in a few passages of Scripture here and there that I think are important passages that advance the narrative. And let me say right up front that I've selected just a few Scriptures. Certainly there are many, many that you could look to. Do you think we need to recite the 17 periods before we get into this? Probably a good idea. One last time. Before the flood? Flood. Scattering of the people. Exodus. Wandering in the wilderness. Conquest. Judges. United Kingdom. Divided Kingdom. Judah alone. Captivity. Return from captivity. Years of silence. Life of Christ. Early church. Letters to Christians. Excellent. Sounds like people have those down pretty well. Okay, let's start going through them a little bit. Before the flood, where do we find that in the Bible? What chapters? Genesis 1 to 5 is correct. So what would you say the key event in chapter 1? What's that about? Creation. How about chapter 2? there we have Adam and Eve in the garden, and the marriage relationship starting. How about chapter 3? That's an important one.
First sin.
That's right. First sin. What else? First promise of a Savior, right? You might want to have your Bibles handy, because we will look to a few scriptures as we go along. The first one I want to read is very short. It's Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. This, of course, comes very early on in the Bible. The Bible I customarily use has 1,573 pages. This turns up on page 4. And Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 is God speaking to the serpent. And he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." And so there we have the first allusion to the Savior who's going to be coming. Now, no one who heard that at the time could understand it, but there it is. Page 4 of my Bible, we have the first allusion to Christ. What about chapter 4? What's in there?
How God created earth.
Nope, the creation is chapter 1. Chapter 4, we have Cain and Abel. Chapter 5, what's there? Generations. And where do those generations take us to? That's really the link to the next period. Generations wind up with Noah, right? And so that's our next period, the flood. And where do we find that in the Bible? Genesis 6 through 10, correct. A few of the key events. What do we have in chapter 6? That's right. Warning and preparation. Chapter 7, we have the flood beginning. What about chapter 8? Flood ends, right? What do we have in chapter 9? We have a number of important events that happen right after the flood. Well, we have God giving instruction to Noah and his family to spread and fill the earth. We've got God authorizing meat for food, instruction on capital punishment, the rainbow covenant. And in chapter 10, we have what? Another set of generations. And those generations involve Noah's sons, right? What is the link to the next period? I kind of gave a hint of it a moment ago. There was a command to fill the earth, right? Did they do it? No, they pretty much refused to do that. They all kind of congregated on the plain of Shinar. And so that brings us to the next period, which is scattering of the people, right? There we have the Tower of Babel, confusing of languages, and so forth. And that period also ended up with generations. These were generations of Shem's sons, of Shem, and he was one of Noah's sons. What's the link to the next period? Where do those generations take us to? To what person?
Abraham,
correct. Now, the next period, of course, is the patriarchs. What chapters do we find discussion of the patriarchs in the Bible? We have Genesis 12 to 50, right? Okay. That's right. Who are the three main patriarchs? We all know this, I would hope. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in what chapters is Abraham the main character? We mentioned the big overarching 12 to 50 for the patriarchs period, but where do we find Abraham as really the main character? It's really chapter 12 through 25, I would say. What about Isaac? Well, he's 25 to 27, or 28. I think we have 28 on our handouts. You could just sort of argue it either way. What about Jacob? He's basically chapter 28 to 35, right? And who's chapter 36 featuring? There's a little insertion of Esau into the patriarchs here. And 36 discusses Esau's generations. And then we come to Joseph. And he's going to be the main character in chapters 37 to 50. Yeah, well, that's why we've been working on it for 6 months. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. We have repeatedly mentioned the threefold promise. This is an important thing. And we first find it in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. I'll read verses 1 to 3, and then verse 6, and the first part of 7. And this is God speaking to Abram. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Verse 6. Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring, I will give this land." So that's the threefold promise in its first iteration. Who else did God state these promises to?
Isaac,
and one more.
Jacob.
And the statement to Isaac is much more succinct. It's really found in one verse in Genesis chapter 26, verse 4. Much more briefly stated than God's statement to Abram that we just read. Speaking to Isaac in Genesis 26, verse 4, God says, "I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And then we find the promises also made to Jacob in chapter 28, verses 12 to 14, in the context of a dream that he had. And so to each of these three, we had God making this important promise: through your offspring, all nations, all people will be blessed. Let's move on to chapter 49. I want to read chapter 49, verse 10. This is Jacob's blessing on his son Judah, right at the end of his life. Jacob stated a number of blessings on his sons, and looking at these, we have to recognize that these were prophetic in nature. In speaking of his son Judah, he said in chapter 49, verse 10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him." New American Standard says, "until Shiloh comes," and Shiloh means peace. "And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." And so we know that this turned out to be the case. The family of David did come through Judah, and then that family continued right on up to Christ. Well, we know that the Israelites ended up down in Egypt, right? And this is an instance where I think we can see God's providence at work. This was a way of making sure his people survived a famine. And his brothers came down, Joseph's brothers came to Egypt. We know the story. The family moved down there. The family grew and grew and grew. And that gives us our next link. The nation had grown very large, and the Egyptians were oppressing the people. Right? We're familiar with that. So that's the link. What's the next period that leads to?
Exodus,
right. Where do we find the Exodus period in the Bible? Anybody know?
Exodus through Numbers 13.
That's right. Exodus through Numbers 13. And just running very quickly through a few events, does anybody want to mention some of what they think are the major events of that time? there are a number of things you could point to. Moses' birth and his upbringing, his education in the palace, his having to flee the wilderness after killing the Egyptian, and then realizing that his people weren't ready to look to him for leadership quite yet. So he flees to the wilderness, and what's the big turning point event that happens to him in the wilderness? And the wilderness is over in Midian, or eastern part of the Arabian Peninsula, perhaps. Right, we have the burning bush incident. And so he goes back, and the plagues happen, those 10 plagues, and the people finally leave Egypt. We have them crossing the Red Sea and making their way to Sinai. We have some really, really important things happening at Mount Sinai. And then they travel to Kadesh Barnea, up in the northern part of the Arabian Peninsula. If you would turn to Exodus 19, I'd like to read verses 4 to 6. This, to me, is a really important passage. It's a critical passage, and if you really take seriously what it says, it goes a long way toward explaining much of the rest of what happens in the Old Testament, I would say. So let's look at those few verses. God speaking to the Israelites in Exodus 19, verses 4 to 6. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel," you being Moses. So we notice that this great offer is definitely contingent upon real obedience. That's something that we've tried to stress over and over again throughout these past 6 months, the importance of obedience to God. Note also the greatness of the offer here. The Israelites could be God's treasured possession among all peoples. If you flip over to Leviticus 26, we're not going to read the whole chapter, but it's a good note to make to yourself, perhaps, that here you find some important things happening, important statements from God, while the Israelites are still at Mount Sinai. And he stresses there that the people are going to have two paths available to them: obedience and blessing, or disobedience and trouble. In the first 13 verses of Leviticus 26, God explains that blessings would come with obedience. And note in particular verses 11 and 12, where he says, "I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you, and will be your God, and you shall be my people." On the other hand, in verses 14 to 39, we have God's statement that serious punishment, terrible punishment, would flow from disobedience. Verse 33, speaking about what would happen if the people are disobedient, God says, "And I will scatter you among the nations, and I will unsheath the sword after you, and your land shall be a desolation, and your cities shall be a waste." And so here, as early as Mount Sinai, we have foreshadowing of the terrible things that we're going to see happening later on to the Israelites. Importantly, in verses 40 to 46 of Leviticus 26, there is a promise to remember the covenant if they confess their sins. Okay, they leave Sinai, they go to Kadesh Barnea. What happens up there in Numbers chapter 13 that really is the link to the next period? That's right. The spies are sent into the land, and they come back and they give their depressing report, and the people just don't have faith, and they refuse to go into the land. And God punishes them, and this is the link to the next period, right? What's the punishment? To wander in the wilderness. And so that's our next period. So test yourself again. Where in the Bible do we find the wandering in the wilderness period? What are the scriptural boundaries of that one?
Numbers 14 through 5.
That's right. Very good. Numbers 14 through Joshua 5. Numbers 14 to 36, Deuteronomy and the first five chapters of Joshua. And what was the real reason for their wandering? If you just wanted to distill the problem down, what would you say?
Generation.
Well, God did decree that that was going to happen, but the real reason why it happened, I would say, was lack of faith and disobedience. That was what God was punishing with the 40 years of wandering. What were some of the events in this period? We went through them a couple of times, quite some time ago now, I guess. But I'm not going to try to list or remember all of them right now, but let's just hit a couple of the ones that we noted earlier. Remember Korah's rebellion, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and connected with that, Aaron's rod that budded. And an important one was the sin of Moses and Aaron. Remember when they were told to speak to the rock for the water to come out, and that's not what they did. And yeah, that's the point. It's the point that's made over and over again. And so we have them having to bypass Edom, and the people grumbling and being depressed, and God getting angry and sending the fiery serpents. We have the Israelites going up to the north and conquering kings Sion and Og. Love those names, by the way. We have the story about Balaam, the account of the people's immorality with the Midianites. And then, importantly, we had a second census. They had taken one earlier at Sinai, and now they take a second census. And then we have Moses' speeches, some really important speeches that he presented to the people just before they crossed the Jordan and went into the land. I'll note just a couple of these. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is just before Moses dies, just before they're about to enter the land. And this chapter is another vivid description of blessings and cursings. Curses, I should say. Blessings and curses that will be determined by what the people do. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and 30. We have a renewal of the covenant with yet another warning that disobedience will lead to their being driven out of the land that they're just about to go into. Let's look at, in particular, Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 to 18, where God says, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to enter and possess." So again, this is just one of a number of warnings of that nature. And at all times, you have to say that the Israelites had a choice. They could choose to be faithful and obedient and receive blessings, or they could choose to be unfaithful and receive curses. Well, they did a couple things in Joshua chapter 5. You might say in preparation for the actual effort to take the land. We've discussed this a few times. They celebrated the Passover. Males were circumcised. That had not been done during the wandering years. And they started eating the produce of the land, and the manna stopped. And so at this point, the 40 years is about over. And so what's our link to the next period? Well, you could say they've served their sentence, and so they're ready to go forward. And so the next period is what? Invasion and conquest of the land, right? Where in the Bible is that? Joshua 6 through 24, through the end of the book. And we have these three phases of them taking the land, three campaigns, central, southern, and northern campaigns. And then they divide the land, and the Transjordanic tribes go back east of the Jordan River. Remember, there were three, I think, who had requested to settle east of the Jordan. Now look at Joshua 21. I want to look at verses 43-45. This is an important passage, I think. And let me backtrack. We can say, I think, with assurance, that looking at the threefold promise, the first promise of the nation had already been filled, and you could say fulfilled, and it had happened when they were at Sinai. They were certainly a nation at that point. There were a lot of people. They had received detailed laws from God. The covenant, God's covenant with them, had been established, and they were a nation with God as their king. So the first of those three promises had been fulfilled at Sinai. Here we're going to have a statement in Joshua 21 that the land promise, the second promise, has been fulfilled. It says, "Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass." Well, as we come to the close of this invasion and conquest period, a couple of important speeches Joshua made to the people. There's one in chapter 23 where he challenges them to finish the conquest of the land and to get rid of all the idolaters in the land. And there's another warning there that they would lose the land if they were disobedient. And then the second speech, chapter 24, is a challenge for them to be faithful to God. And let's look at verses 14 and 15, a passage that I'm sure is familiar to all of us. It says, Joshua talking to the people, "Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day who you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Well, would you say that that admonition stuck? Did it take with the people?
No.
Not really. If it had, a lot of problems would have been avoided. Well, what's the link from this invasion and conquest period to the next period? And the next period, of course, is what? Judges, right? Well, what's the link from one period to the next? I think we characterized it in the handouts as there arose a generation that knew not God, so God sent, and Jim trailed off a series of periods, I think, meaning that led to God sending judges. Where in the Bible do we find the period of the judges? You can guess the first book. It's part of it, right? So we start with Judges. What else does it encompass? Ruth and 1 Samuel 1 through 9. Who were some of the judges? Just give me a couple names of the better known ones, the stories about whom that we tend to really enjoy when we're kids in Bible classes. These are some of the best things in the Bible for kids, I think, the stories of some of these judges. Who are your favorites when you were a kid? Right. Anyone else? Gideon? Deborah, I think, is another popular one.
Just a bunch of guys with an Oscar?
Shamgar. He's not a real well-known one, although I have to note that I once heard a preacher deliver a 45-minute sermon just on Shamgar, the one or two verses that speak about him. And he drew a great lesson out of that. As I recall, this was a long time ago I heard this, but the point of his lesson was that Shamgar made do with what was available to him. He used what he had, and he accomplished great things. And the point was we should use what we have, what God provides to us, to do good for him. Well, what happened in 1 Samuel chapter 8 that really was the link to the next period? We know that the people demanded to have a king. And why did they do that? Why were they so set on having a king? Right. Samuel was the last judge, and he was getting old. His sons were rotten, and no one could see his sons taking over as judges. And the people, I mean, you have to say it, they lack faith. They want to be like the neighboring kingdoms. And when you think about the implications of this, it's drastic. They seemed not to properly understand who their king really was, had been God all along. And they're not satisfied with the arrangement, so they demand a king. And that takes us into the next period, which, of course, is the United Kingdom. The three kings of the United Kingdom we know, Saul, David, Solomon, right? Where in the Bible? Before we go into detail, let me just mention again, we know that there are two parallel narratives in the Old Testament about the United Kingdom, the divided kingdom, and Judah alone. We have two tracks. They overlap to some extent, but not completely. They include six Bible books. Which books are in the first narrative? I'll call it the first narrative, as opposed to narrative one or narrative A. Well, we have 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And so what do we have in the second narrative? We have 1 and 2 Chronicles, right? All right, let's go into a little more detail. And as I think I've mentioned before, this, when I was trying to learn this material, was the part that gave me the most trouble, that I had to look at the most to try to grind it into my head. What's the boundaries in the first narrative for the United Kingdom? I'll tell you that it starts in 1 Samuel chapter 10, but how far does it go?
1 Kings 12.
That's right. 1 Kings 11 would be the end of it, where King Solomon dies. And we find King Saul in 1 Samuel 10 being anointed, and his reign carries over through the end of 1 Samuel. 2 Samuel is basically about David's reign, and the first 11 chapters of 1 Kings are about Solomon. What about the second narrative? Where do we find the United Kingdom in the second narrative? I'll give you the start. 1 Chronicles 10. How far does it go? 2 Chronicles 9, correct. Only thing about Saul in this one is the fact that he died. We have David in 1 Chronicles 11 through the end of 1 Chronicles. We have Solomon as reigning in the first 9 chapters of 2 Chronicles. Turn, if you would, to 2 Samuel 7. And let's look at the last line of verse 11. Reading on through verse 16. This concerns a key promise in God's plan, entirely consistent with the promises that have been made earlier that we've looked at this morning. But here's a little more detail. Picking up toward the end of verse 11, it says, "Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Here's the key line. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. Well, how'd that play out? We know in the case of Solomon, he had his problems. He became unfaithful. And in 1 Kings 11, verses 9 to 13, which we won't read, but God informed Solomon that the kingdom was going to be divided as a result of his sin. And that's really the link to the next period, Solomon's unfaithfulness. That takes us to what? What's the period after the United Kingdom? Divided Kingdom. Tough question. Where in the first narrative do we find the United Kingdom, the Divided Kingdom, rather? Well, we have 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17. Second narrative, we have 2 Chronicles 10 to 29. And we remember the situation, right? We've got the northern kingdom of Israel. We've got the southern kingdom of Judah. Who was on the throne in Judah, the southern kingdom? Who was reigning? It was David's family, right? That didn't change. What about in the north? How would you compare the situation in the north? I think we noted when we went over this before that it was much, much more unstable in the north. The ruling dynasty changed something like 9 times. And in the south, we had some good kings. You can't really say that about any of the kings in the north. A few of them had their good moments, perhaps, but if you wanted to characterize their overall rule, you would have to say all the kings in the north were evil or bad. One of the overall lessons or points, one of the most striking things as you read through this period, I think, is the simple point that we've been noting this morning, that falling away from God brings trouble. We see that very dramatically during this period. There are a number of prophets that were working, and we have a number of the writing prophets in this period. We won't talk about all of them. I do want to remind you again, though, to add the name Obadiah to the list that's on that first handout that you received at the start of the class. I did forget to put Obadiah's name in there, I think. Well, why did Israel fall? And who did they fall to, first of all? Assyrians, right? We have a summary of reasons for their fall in 2 Kings 17, verses 7 to 18. A bunch of related reasons stated there, and we won't read that passage. It's kind of lengthy. But if you do read it, you can extract from there these related reasons for Israel's fall to Assyria. They followed the ways of other nations, and they worshipped other gods. Related to that, they followed the disobedient ways of their own kings. God sent prophets to them, and they ignored the admonitions and warnings of God's prophets. And related to all of this, they rejected God's commands. They really rejected his covenant with them. And that's, in a nutshell, why they fell. So they fell, and that's the link to the next period, which, of course, is Judah alone. Where is that in the first narrative? This should be getting a little easier as we go through this, but it would be 2 Kings 18 to 25, right? What about in the second narrative? 2 Chronicles 30 to 36, right? Can you name a couple of the good kings you might characterize as better than the other kings in Judah during this time period? Yeah, I think Josiah would be considered to be the best. Another good one was Hezekiah, but Josiah usually gets the top billing in the things that I've read. The period lasted about 135 years, and I forgot to note, I think, that the divided kingdom lasted for 200 years, and so it ended. And then the Judah alone period carried on for another 135 years. And what empire was in power when Judah eventually fell? Babylonian Empire, right? And that's all of this had been foretold, but the Babylonians invaded, and in phases they took Judah into next period, captivity. There's an overlap, I would have to say, between those two periods, Judah alone and captivity, in that it didn't all happen at one time. You know, some people were taken away at first. I think Daniel and his friends were in the first group taken, and then another group was taken later on, and then finally Jerusalem was destroyed, and nobody was left except some of the very poorest people. And so you can see there was an overlap there. And toward the end of this, I can't say exactly the point in time that Jeremiah wrote his words that we find in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34. But let's read that one, because this is another important promise of God that carries forward the ones that we've been talking about this morning. Certainly, a lot of the people have been taken away by the time that Jeremiah writes this. He's writing it to exiles. Again, I'm not sure whether Jerusalem has been destroyed yet, but he writes this. After promising them better times, he talks about a new and better covenant. He says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." Very important foretelling of the covenant that came with Christ, the one that we are living under now. Well, we know they didn't remain captives forever. That's the link to the next period, which is the return. We know that we typically characterize the return from captivity as happening in three phases or returns. I think you could say two and probably have an argument for that as well. But we know in 536 BC, there were a couple of men leading the first return. Who were they? We know Zerubbabel and Jeshua. And what was the main purpose of the first return? What was the big task that they wanted to accomplish that took them a long time to do? Right, they wanted to rebuild the temple. The prophets who encouraged the work at that time were Haggai and Zechariah. You know, they went back, what's the date I just gave you, 536. They didn't actually get it done until the years 520 to 516 BC, but they did get it done. Bible books covering this, Ezra, first six chapters, and you would look at Haggai and Zechariah. About out of time, but let's just note the second return date was 458 BC, led by Ezra. Main focus was to purify the worship. Third return, around 445 BC. This is one where I'm not sure I'd characterize it as a return, because it was basically Nehemiah. And the main purpose there was to rebuild the Jerusalem city walls. And we read about that in Nehemiah, of course. The book of Esther falls probably between Ezra chapter 6 and chapter 7. And we have the last Old Testament prophet Malachi around 432 BC. And the people, in the end, they simply don't live up to God's plan for them. And that's the link to the next period, which was the years of silence, which Amos had foretold in Amos chapter 8, verse 11, a passage that Jim has noted more than once, I think, throughout the class. Well, it looks like we are out of time. We almost got through our review. So anyway, thank you for your attention. I would encourage everybody to keep on saying the 17 periods to yourself. As we go forward into the detailed study, it will stand you in good stead to remind yourself of all this material. And if you don't do that, if you're like me, you'll forget it pretty shortly. Thanks again.
distinct. We're having people downstairs, so if you're in week 5, you go downstairs.
We're in week 4, but we don't mind going down.
Okay. I'm just saying, like, for the group, can you announce?
Oh, yeah. Announcement here. Alex just let me know that we are going to need to use the downstairs area today. If you are in group 5 and are scheduled to go downstairs, it would be a good day for you to do that.
Good to go. Okay.